Everybody, Jeff Dunham. Welcome to the fourth episode of the Jeff Dunham Podcast. I am joined by my buddies Matt McNeil and Jeff Rothman. Gentlemen, everything okay today so far? Yes, maybe?
Doing great.
All right, good. So, you know, today we're going to be talking with a guy that has been in the business forever, and I had a great conversation with him. But David Copperfield is a staple in show business. I mean, this guy has been around, as I say, when I first talking to him, he's been in the business for over half a century. And, you know, it's one of those things you don't remember. It's kind of like Queen Elizabeth. Been around forever. You don't remember a point in your lifetime when David Copperfield wasn't there. Am I right?
That's right. Yeah, I remember like watching specials, I think, when I was a kid, but he still looks the same.
Oh, magic.
Yeah, that's magic. That is tough to figure out. It really is. I mean, the guy is he's timeless. Dick Clark aged worse than David Copperfield.
Oh yeah. And I used to watch every one of his specials, and my whole thing was just, of course, like everybody else, I'm trying to figure out how he makes the Statue of Liberty disappear, and I'd be all critical, but meanwhile I tuned in and watched the whole thing.
Sure.
Every single one.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, and I'm going, he must be paying those people to say that it's gone, but it's really there.
And yeah. but no. No, and no. And what's interesting is about those specials, and most of those were on CBS. Do you know I'll talk about this during the interview. I don't want to give it all away. His first special, do you know how old he was on ABC? How old do you think he was, his first television special? Guess. Just guess.
I mean, he had to be young, of course, but
20? Try just barely old enough to drink. He was 21 years old. Well, back then you could drink at 18,
that's
but
crazy.
Yeah, 21. It's like wow.
Wow, to have your own special.
Yeah, it's like when were the tough years where you were hungry? I don't think he ever. We talked about that. I don't think he ever had them. He never had them. It was just constant success going up and up and up and up. And it's it's amazing. And his success now and his wealth, it's well earned because he never quits. The number of shows that he does a week, when we're in a normal society without COVID is just, it's crazy. It's absolutely nuts. But he does point out that since he doesn't talk very much or not a lot, he's not like a singer or, whatever, stand up. So he can do that number of shows. He'll do 3 shows a day without missing a beat.
Oh, wow. And it's all like mostly illusions, big illusions.
Yeah, there's a difference between, I talk about this with him, there's a difference between an illusionist, a magician, and a mentalist. And we'll figure out in the episode. So, Matt, you same thing. You grew up watching him, right?
Oh, yeah. Growing up, my brother and I sort of like, we didn't stalk him, but if he was on HBO or if he was, or ABC or CBS or wherever, his primetime specials were on, we were there. And then when he came touring live, when I was in North Carolina, my brother and I were always in the audience. So I've seen him more than a few times live, and every single time, like, it's like the show was amazing.
And, I like to ask everybody, when do you think was that moment? What was that moment when you knew you'd made it or you said, all right, this is it? And you, of course, get a different answer from everybody. And the answer today usually is it's just an accumulation of things. There's not this one aha moment. But I think when you know you've made it is when you become a pop culture reference.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. And so yeah. Who hasn't used David Copperfield as, the magician reference? I do it over and over. Even with those new guys that have come along, they're great. But to me, and of course, it's a generational thing, it's still Copperfield. Mm-hmm. That's the magician.
He's the
that's
guy.
The illusionist. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And to me, he seemed like he was the guy that changed the template for all of that stuff, though. Like prior to him, it was like Blackstone, which was like a guy in a tuxedo, or it was Doug Henning, which was a sort of a hippie-ish guy. But David Copperfield really kind of brought like a little bit of that rock and roll or something to the table that like changed all of that stuff and made you want to tune in.
Sure.
Yeah, he was kind of like a nice looking guy too. Like he wasn't like any kind of a nerdy magician in a store or anything. It was big stuff and he looked good.
Yeah. It was event television.
Really good.
Yeah.
Really
good. okay, Jeff.
Somebody's cast a spell on Jeff.
Forget it.
Sure. It's interesting, Matt, you said that Blackstone was in a tuxedo and then Doug Henning comes along and he's the hippie. So I guess that was Doug Henning's answer to the Blackstone type of magician. And then Copperfield right. comes along, and he's now he's like a third thing. He's completely different from both of those guys.
Mm-hmm. But don't you remember it was like, you know, David Copperfield floating across the Grand Canyon with Bonnie Tyler singing Waiting for a Hero or whatever on the other side? Like, it was, I mean, it was like, you know, that MTV era. Yeah. It was like, it was a thing. It was rock and roll, you know,
oh, absolutely.
For my yeah. generation.
And he talks about yeah. that, how important the music is to him in the specials and in the live shows. It's very important. So, you know, when he blows up a building, he plays it when he comes out and he's okay. He plays, of course, Burning Down the House.
And, that's cool.
Yeah. So David Byrne singing along, and David Copperfield's like, I'm okay. Look at me. I'm fantastic. Yeah. He is Mr. Cool, though. I got to tell you. It's great.
Oh, yeah. And he had the great looking assistants, if I'm allowed to say that these days. And although you never see any magician with like an ugly assistant or anything, right? Like, they're all. Is that wrong?
That might be wrong.
It might be wrong. We can't talk about that. Anymore. Oh. Are magicians going to now start having ugly assistants?
They have to.
Yeah, you have to include everybody.
Oh, no. I'm going to stop right now. We're going to get into trouble.
I'm sorry.
There's nothing wrong with an ugly assistant for a magician. I just got to say that. Right. They make fine assistants.
They work really hard.
All right. So, folks, I can easily say that David Copperfield is a friend, and that's how the introduction starts. So here we go. Well, folks, if you don't know who he is, you have not been on this planet for the last, I'd say, half a century, or your parents haven't talked about him, please help me welcome a guy who I think I can call my friend, Mr. David Copperfield.
You're my friend. Is correct. Friend is correct. I want that mic when you're done with it. I want that mic.
Yeah,
it you put the red inside of it. You put the red detail inside it. It come like that.
Wow! Oh no, it came like that. It was their anniversary model. So yeah,
There you go. Happy anniversary.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I don't know how many years the thing goes back to the '40s. I think something like that.
I think so. It looks 40, 40-ish.
And Mr. Copperfield, you are sitting where right now?
I'm in my museum, my secret museum. Not a secret anymore. You're here.
Right. And the museum, what is it called? It's a very big name.
It is. It's called David's Museum.
No, it's not. What's it called?
International Museum and Library of the Conjuring Arts.
That's pretty great. And, you know, people get confused when, this is a stupid question, but what's the difference between an illusionist, a magician, and a mentalist? And if I can answer my own question, I think yes. You have a little bit of all of that in your show. Is that correct?
That is correct, sir.
Okay.
But if you call yourself an illusionist, you get paid 20% more. Bing.
Well, it's a little more than 20%. And I, you know, it was a little bit annoying researching what I didn't know about you, because I always try and research. I want to talk about the person first. But the breadth of your career, David, is unbelievable. And I was amazed looking at it all. And it's almost hard to figure out where to start. But for those folks who, okay, so you've been at the MGM Grand now for how long? Since 2000?
About 20 years. Before that, I was at your hotel at Caesars. I was there 15 years. And before that, I was the Riviera and all kinds of other stuff, opening for people, being the kind of the co-headliner. I co-headlined with Crystal Gayle. And Shecky Green, opened for Shecky Green.
So, but those were during the touring years. But you've been in residency at the MGM since the beginning of the century, correct?
What century?
This one.
Yes, I think so. That's
all right. So that means that there is a young generation that you're a pop culture reference, but they may not have seen what got you where you are now. If they have not been to a live show, is that fair enough? Is that fair to say?
I'm on the YouTube machine and I make my appearance on the Country Music Awards and the Kennedy Center Honors every now and then. So
sure, absolutely. You know, but what you did to get you where you are now is the achievements are unbelievable. I just want to run through a couple of these things so folks will know exactly. Who we're talking to right now, if they're not familiar, and to remind them,
okay.
Because I'm telling you, it doesn't get any bigger than this. This is if anyone thinks they're successful, just look at David Copperfield's accomplishments, and you'll say to yourself, "Well, I suck," because that's pretty much what I did in the last couple of days. I had a look at everything and I went, you know, I thought I'd gotten somewhere, but nope. And I must say this, David, if you're at the top of the field in the magic world, and I'm at the top of the field in the ventriloquism world, there is a huge difference between success in magic and success in ventriloquism.
I'm not sure. You're doing just great.
Okay, just great.
Dunham, you're doing great.
Thanks. But let me look at just a couple of these things, then we'll get to the meat of this whole interview here. This is what I call David Copperfield is a success, and you're not. Here we go. About half a century of performing. I got that right, right? Right in there?
Yeah.
Okay, here we go. Television specials, 21 Emmy Awards and 38 nominations. Now, the only way I can make myself feel better on that, David, is that you've lost 17 times. Okay, thanks.
It's true.
Yeah, all right. But 21 Emmy Awards. It's amazing. And at age 21, you got your first ABC special. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Unbelievable. At age 21. What
the
heck?
Me and Donnie and Marie.
Oh, well, all right, great. Well, I don't know what happened to them. Anyway.
Doing just great.
All right, yeah, I know they are. So then you moved on to CBS. You have had 18 specials total on network TV, is that correct?
I think more than that, actually, but that's okay.
All right, I don't know. These could be old stats. 11 Guinness World Records. And again, here we go, the spread between careers here. I can't compare myself to you. I have one Guinness World Record. You have 11! All right. Let's see. A star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Well, who doesn't have that, right?
That's true.
Okay.
But I was the first living illusionist. I broke the glass ceiling of that story. So.
Oh, that's pretty great. So everybody else that got every other illusionist and magician that got a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame was dead. It was post person. Is that correct?
Houdini had one. Then I was the first living one. Then a whole bunch of people like Penn and Teller. Did very good on their own.
That's pretty great. All right, and then you have a knighthood by the French government. I don't even know what that means, but that's great. I saw Monty Python in Search of the Holy Grail, so I'm not sure if
two kisses and a little medal.
That's impressive. You're big in France. All
there
right.
were wet kisses. There were wet French kisses.
All right, so many jokes. Named a living legend by the U.S. Library of Congress. So what happens after you die?
You're one of the dead legends of the...
All right. Perfect. You have your museum there, the International Museum of Museum and Library of the Conjuring Arts. Now, here's the big one. You think you're successful and you go and you buy a nice car and then you're David Copperfield and you buy a bunch of islands. So 11 resort islands in the Bahamas, the Musha Cay and the islands of David Copperfield Bay. Is that it?
Just Copperfield Bay.
Oh, I'm sorry. And Copperfield Bay. Sorry. So, I mean, this is where you go. Folks can rent this thing out. Companies can rent these out and it's a resort and it's top dog stuff. It's top dollar stuff. It is. How do you describe this?
Tan. Can you tell me? I just got back. Is my tan a good representation?
and you have an entire staff there, correct?
Yeah. It's about 40 people there.
40 people. And have they been riding the pandemic out there? You're just letting them stay there? Is that how
we
works?
Are actually a testing center. We're actually a testing center for COVID.
You're being serious?
I'm dead serious.
Dead serious. That's not a good way to put it. So what do you mean a testing center? What are you testing?
They put stuff up your nose and they put them in tubes and they say, you're good. That's it.
Man. All right. That's amazing. All right. Don't worry. We're going to get to discussing here in a second. I'm almost done. I'm not even going to talk about the money because money goes with all this and I'm not even going to mention it. But you've grossed more than any entertainer in the history of this planet. Is that correct? You're not going to answer that. I just know it's a fact. Huh?
Okay.
Okay.
Did a lot of shows. I'm like you.
Okay.
Well, I was out there doing those arenas. I was hitting those arenas.
I'm getting to that point, David, because I'm sound like I'm being facetious, but I'm not, because you have worked for this. You have earned it. There is nobody gave you anything. You toured for years. And you know, what I loved about this is with the specials, you and I had this discussion before, when it came to doing the specials, you would basically practice the special on the road before you shot it, correct?
Isn't that what you do, honestly? I mean, there's no other person who is a ventriloquist that sells out arenas. I think maybe in history, you're the only person that has sold out arenas as a ventriloquist. fair to say, correct?
Okay. Okay. Yeah, sure.
That's true.
There were no arenas when Bergen was around.
That's not true. Oh. That's absolutely not true.
Okay.
And, you know, you're the only person to do that. And you continue to do that. So that's pretty good. That's what I did for many, many years as a magician. So I was a magician guy.
Right.
I was the Jeff Dunham of magic.
You're so kind. But
I did that over and over. But, you know, you have to use your voice. I don't have to use my voice as much. So I could do 3 shows a day and 4 shows a day. I'd show up to Japan and Janet Jackson would do a show. She has to sing. She has to dance. I would do 3 shows the next day, not because I was so wonderful, because I could, you know, and people showed up. That was amazing. And it was very nice. I still love doing shows. I do 640 shows a year.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. You're jumping ahead of me here, but that's the crazy thing. So before the pandemic hit, at the MGM Grand, you were doing how many shows a week?
15 a week.
So 15 a week and like 42 weeks a year, something nuts like that?
That's right. But it's not an arena, so.
But still, it seats, what, 600 people, something like that?
More than that. More than that.
You don't want people. Okay. And how long is the show, typical show? Not typical, it's that length.
It's about an hour and a half, somewhere in there, hour and a half.
Okay, now here, you think I'm going to go a bad direction here, but what's the average price for a ticket for your show?
I don't know. It depends. Is $100 tickets, $200 tickets? Depends where you sit and where you go.
Okay, now the average person is going to sit there and go, $100, $200 to see a magic show? What in the world? And then you come in and they say, that's expensive. How can they charge that? And then you go to your show, and after the show, after all the production and the performance and the brilliance of it all, you say, how in the world do they only charge $100 a head for that? Because it is an event. And I want to touch on that in a little while on how smartphones and easy special effects have affected magicians and how they may have affected you and now how important the live show is. But I want to talk about it in a minute. So before the pandemic, now during the pandemic, you've just been you and I were on the phone a little bit right before we pulled the plug, and now you're coming back, correct?
Correct.
And that's starting out soon.
Monday.
Yes. Okay. So, this will have been on, you will have been on stage 2 nights when this thing finally drops.
It was a great 2 shows. I was great for 2 shows.
It's fantastic. All right. So, before we get started here, I have to go back to who you were in high school.
Yet.
No,
we haven't started.
I have to go back to, you know, who you, because at age 20, you hit it big, but who were you in high school? Were you like the nerd? Were you, I mean, what was it? You grew up in New Jersey. So what in the world?
I think we were all the nerd, right? We were all of us. As you know, I started as a ventriloquist. I was not Jeff Dunham level. I was a really crappy level, but I loved it. I loved puppetry, ventriloquism. I loved it. And that puppetry brought me into a magic shop to buy a better puppet because it couldn't have been me. It had to be the lousy puppet. So I went searching and I saw all this magic stuff and I said, I'm going to do this. And magic became very easy to me. So it became I loved inventing new things. You know, in high school, I was always inventing new magic effects. I was teaching magic at NYU. When I was 16 years old, I would go from high school in Montauk, New Jersey, and take the bus and teach at NYU. All the kids are older than me. But magic I was good at, and everything else I sucked at. So magic was the way to be, to feel special and to excel. And I got a lot of appreciation, which motivates you even more. And I loved it. And I still love it, actually.
Well, one of the quotes that cracked me up that I found online was, it says, he was shy and a loner. The young Copperfield saw magic as a way to fit in and later to meet women. Now, I'm going to stop right here. So if you're going to want to meet women, I used to joke about this. The best way to meet women is to become a ventriloquist. And, of course, that's completely facetious. So was it really in your head, I can get chicks?
Isn't ventriloquism a birth control device?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
So later in life, because you are, you know, one in 10 million of a guy that succeeds and women go, David Copperfield. Yeah. But before you were happily married, of course. But were girls really attracted to you in your early 20s because of the magic?
I think, you know, when you need something to share and need something to kind of make you feel special, magic was really helpful in that way. I provided an excuse to communicate, and, you know, then it's up to you. But, yeah, it was a good icebreaker, as they say.
Well, you know, what's funny is you made the magician sexy. So whose idea was that? Because before you, it was what, Doug Henning, and he looked like Gallagher. So you kind of changed that mold, right?
Yeah.
Was it a stylist, or did you come up with it?
I think I lacked a stylist. Actually, go look at some of those tapes, and the haircuts were really, you know, really special, and some of the clothing choices not so good. But it kind of it worked out okay. You know, I always. You know, I've said this in interviews before. It's never been about the magic trick or fooling people. It was always about stories, about emotions. And, you know, I always didn't look up to magicians as much as I looked up to Frank Sinatra or Dean Martin or Fred Astaire or, you know, Gene Kelly. And they were all kind of romantic heroes. And I wanted to take magic and become something people could relate to. And my magic wasn't about vanishing a girl. It was vanishing an old girlfriend at a table and the memories of a thing like that, or doing the shower scene from Psycho, or it was a date with a magician where I cut somebody in half. It's kind of an MGM. It always had a theme to it and context. And that's what I did. And that was what kind of separated me a bit at that time.
Well, I must say, when you go to your show, it's like a great film. You're taken through those roller coaster of emotions. There's humor in it. There's some comedy in it. There's the tear jerking moments. There's the poignant moments. There's the amazing moments. And is that what lacks in a lot of performers, magicians, illusionists shows, is that they don't have that breadth of emotion? Because after I leave your show, I thought this was an amazing journey doing all this, seeing it all.
That's very kind. I think various magicians have their own style. If somebody's extremely funny, that might be enough. Somebody is very artistic and aesthetically beautiful and looks like a little piece of art, that's also okay. I try to do you know, you talk about mind reading and so forth, where you're connecting with people, with their thoughts and what they bring to the show. I love all those things, you know, and I wanted to do what every opening act that I could have would do. I'd want to be funny. I'd want to be emotional. I'd want to have all those things, because every single person I admired had a wide range of places the audience could go. And I love watching comedy. I love studying comedy. I love studying music and dance. And so combining those things, using magic as my kind of my hamburger there, was good. And that
speaking of music, I noticed that in a couple of specials that you really, and some of those songs that you got must have been crazily expensive. But I did notice that the music was, and it is in your live show as well. It's hugely important for those emotions, and it adds so much to the show. So unlike a comedian, where you have to, you know, a comedian gets up there and tells jokes and can take you through story and up and down, but there's way more to this, to what you do, than people see on the surface. And there's not a day you wake up that you don't think about your act. Is that correct?
New stuff, you know, inventing new material, writing, you know, it's enjoyable to me. But, you know, Dunham, you're talking about yourself. You know, you get up every day and you're either carving or writing or think of a new bit or a new idea. That's what you do. You have to. It's not because you want to do it. It's you have to do it. It's like you feel like you have to do it. Everybody that I speak to that has, you know, a big career. I mean, I was with a lover of magic, is J.J. Abrams. He loves magic. He was here at this museum, and he said to me, David, I have to write. I love to write. I can't just sit there. I have to create new stuff. It's no fun if I'm not creating new stuff. And I went, nah, I understand what you're talking about. That's exactly right. You know, it makes me feel happy. I enjoy going on the jet ski on the island. I enjoy seeing movies. But usually when I see a movie, I'm going, is there anything I can gain from this? Is there anything that a direction that I've learned from this experience that I just had? Yeah.
Well, was there any moment in all of this where you finally said, was there that moment where you said, this is it, this is, I've made it, I've done what I thought I could, and then from then on it was just extra gravy? Or was it just all building and building and building to what it's become?
I think people think I'm full of crap, but I still am trying to get it right. I'm still trying to get it right. You know, honestly, sometimes I look back and say, that was a pretty good thing, or I like that. There's certain things that I've done that I think are good work, but certainly I can't look at them without saying, I could have tweaked that or could have changed that a bit. You know, when you're doing a special, don't you look at it, and if you do look at it, and say, oh, God, I wish I just had one little thing there, if I rephrase that or flip that word structure around, you know, to have the chance to do that. I don't spend too much time doing that, but don't you have that experience?
Yeah, of course. And I, you know, I wish I'd done this, wouldn't have done that. But I also sometimes can't stand watching myself. It's like I'll go for a long time doing a live show over and over and over again, and finally I'll have to force myself to sit back and watch it. And then it's, I think, why in the world didn't I do this before? And look what I'm doing here. And then it's a big improvement.
Yep.
So was there ever a fork in the road moment that you can look back now and say, if I hadn't made this decision, or if this hadn't have happened, this, you know, the butterfly moment, that if that hadn't happened, I wouldn't be where I am today. Is there one for you?
Well, I went to an office, at the time, there was a management company called Rollins, Jaffe and Mora. And they produced Woody Allen films. They produced Robin Williams. They managed all these amazing talents. And I said, you know, can you do something for this magician guy? And they go, no, we can't help you. I said, but go across the street to this guy named Joe Cates. And Joe Cates, you know, Phoebe Cates from Fast Times, Ridgemont High, wonderful actress, married to Kevin Klein now. Her father was the guy that discovered me. I knocked on his door, and he said, you know, come this way. I see you have a unique approach to what you're doing, and, you know, you're the right age group at that time. And he gave me my big break. So that was a very important moment for me. You know, I know the moments where they didn't work out well. I don't want to talk about too specifically, but where I would focus on one person in a group, a very important group of executives, and dismiss one of the other executives. And that executive becomes the head person of all time. You know, it's like, oh, God, why did I make the mistake of not, you know, focusing on that person that eventually would be promoted into a place they could have done me a lot of good. You know, so you learn those lessons very well, to be nice to everybody and to be really respectful and not dismissive. So.
Sure. I was always taught you never know who you're going to meet going up or coming down. And yeah, Leno has a bunch of those stories as well. So how about that? And I mentioned this to you a couple of days ago that I might ask you about, but there has to be those moments that you died on stage. But again, this goes so far back, and people say this to me, I can't imagine you dying on stage, but there had to be, and not just because something went wrong. Is there any time where you just did not connect?
Huh. You know, it took me a while. We did 28 shows during COVID, where they allowed us to do a limited show.
Wait, at MGM, you did 28 shows.
And 28 shows. And for the first week, it was kind of a challenge because we were 25 feet away from the audience. Try that one, Mr. Dunham. Wow. 25 feet away from them. Actually, you have that experience. And they were all 6 feet apart. The groups were 6 feet apart. And I had to spend a week figuring it out. And it wasn't changing what I said. It was intonation and pausing and raising and lowering the volume to finally get to a place where the audience had an experience that I was satisfied with. And I looked forward to every show to twist and change and want to try things out. It was kind of a wonderful thing at the end of the day, but, you know, hard, but wonderful.
You know, that's something that I think non-performers don't quite understand, and that's the synergy between the audience and the performer. And Howie was kind of bashing on musicians a little bit, how you just get up there and play your song and it doesn't matter and you leave. And saying it was a lot easier than comedy.
Partially true.
Right.
As far as immediate reaction, that would be true, right? You can just plow through it. And I can plow through illusion things, but, you know, I'm not going to be satisfied until I hear the reaction that I know is going to come during that segment, you know? And I'm doing a lot of comedies, you know, I'm talking a lot during the show in between things. And so it really matters if the audience is kind of getting the experience that I hope they're getting, that they should be getting.
And it's strange because you don't have to say a word when you walk into that theater getting ready to go on. You can just tell when you're backstage ready to walk on, and I don't know what it is, but you get that sense. Is it the volume that they're discussing things? But you kind of know before you walk on how this is going to go. Is that right?
Is that true of you?
Yeah, I can walk from from my bus to backstage, and I walk up to Robin Tate, my promoter, and I go, "Uh-oh, this isn't going to go very well." Because you can just kind
what?
Of
what?
Because you can.
What do you feel?
Either the energy or you don't. And again, you can't put your finger on it, but it's just an intuition that's developed over years because of the volume of the crowd, or I don't know what it is, just so many inputs there that you know, it's like soup. You don't know why it's good, but it's good.
You know why soup is good.
Because
it's the MSG content.
Oh, of course it is. Oh, that speaking of MSG, that brings up another question.
When I played Madison Square Garden.
I wish I had sound effects. I'd get your rim shot right there. Your audiences are unbelievably international. It's amazing. And you've toured every continent, every country in the world, just about. Everything but Antarctica. Is that about right?
That's true.
We should do a show together in Antarctica just to say we could or did.
Yeah. Shiver.
So the international crowd... you do, as you say, talk a lot in the show, but English being the international language. But when you look out at that crowd, is there? I mean, it's different every single night, every single show, correct? And aren't they from everywhere?
Correct. I spent lots of time in China. I walked through the wall of China, but I actually spent lots of time there touring. So the people from China come to see me. South America. I've done. And Germany and France and London, toured all those places like 10 times. I did 10 world tours, which is pretty pretty amazing. And they come to see me. And in those countries, I speak their language. I fake it, kind of like Charo. You know, I used her role model act. She wouldn't say Mississippi, she'd say Mississippi. You know, his whole act was her malapropism, you know, comedy, and I would do that in my show. And I would have things all written on the stage, how to speak their language with very bad Spanish or French or whatever, and they would laugh and in Chinese, and they, you know, and I'd get something right, they'd get very excited for me. And all these people come to my show expecting me to do that, but I don't do that in my show here in Vegas. I can't speak 27 languages, you know. What do you do? Where do you perform besides USA?
We've done a couple of world tours as well. I mean, South Africa and everywhere in Europe, right. in the UK, and you know, I just keep going. Canada, we do Canada. So,
and you know, in South Africa, the audience was so great and so appreciative. Were they good for you?
Oh yeah, that in Australia as well. They're fantastic, and I don't know why it is. Is it me, or they just appreciate the fact that I bothered to get on that 28-hour flight? I don't know.
Well, for me, it was so good that I flew in Mike's speaker system, audio people, to record the audience, and we recorded like 20 shows or something like that of the South African audience. And when I did the TV special, I took all that audio and put it on my show here, which is also good, but this is so amazing. It was great.
So they're laughing in South African.
That's correct. And I'm playing in Brooklyn.
All right. So, and that brings this to the annoying thing right now with the political correctness and knowing what to say and what not to say. And, you know, you say one phrase or one joke and you get in trouble, you get canceled. Is it, even with what you do, you've had to change a bit, correct?
You know, they are right, not to cancel, but, you know, we're all getting better for this, I think, and to learn from our mistakes and learn from things we did that were just insensitive. So I think it's a good thing. I know a lot of comedians feel they're being stifled a lot. You know, not me. I'm good. I think I have so many diverse people in the audience, luckily, and they still like me. And I think, you know, getting it right so everyone's really respected. You know, the people themselves were never, ever, when you maybe push the line and make, you know, kids somebody about an accent, the person would never get upset. It was the people around them that would be upset. And they're right, too. So, I'm doing my best.
Yeah, it's difficult. And I say it's annoying just because we have to watch it so much. And as I said before, there used to be the sanctity of the live show where you could, you know, have fun with it. And everybody had a sense of humor. But now everybody's so sensitive. And I understand what you're saying, that we're learning. And I think that's a good answer. And it's accurate. And it's right. But it is tough for somebody like me who... Maybe we're not making fun of people at all. I make fun of myself more than I do anybody, but it has stifled a bit what we can talk about. And even talking about this right now, the way I'm talking about it, can almost get you into trouble. So it's troublesome.
I think it's troublesome. I think, you know, what you said is right. We're learning. And along that journey, hopefully people allow us to continue to improve and evolve and learn. I like that it's does provide a challenge, because instinctually you want to find funniness or comedy or, you know, a joy in every moment. Some of that joy, if that joy goes into the other person's expense, that's not so great. There's a way of accomplishing it without that. And I think that's good.
Yeah, I think that it definitely is. It's almost like the comedian who has been blue his entire career, his or her entire career, and then suddenly has to do a clean show. It's a little bit of a challenge.
You know, I was friendly before he passed away with Otto and George, and he was doing Letterman show, and how is he going to pull this off? Because every single word is the F word in his show, you know, and every word. But he kind of got through it, and it was kind of funny, and it worked. So being challenged and being kind of boxed in does help. I saw many comedians have to work on you. How is it they can do it? And they kind of, if they're good, they find a way of pulling through it.
Sure, and you're having to learn how to do comedy without picking on people, without making fun of people. That's a little bit different, because difficult for some people, because that's most of the act. So it is causing people to...
Where's my act?
What else am I going to do? Let's talk a little bit more about the magic and the illusions now. With the smartphones and all the, you know, anybody who can afford a smartphone can now do these crazy illusions with the cheap software. So if you were starting out today, do you feel sorry for the guy starting out in illusions and magic now? I mean, what would you be doing right now? Is it crazily difficult? Because when you did your specials, you did them all. You did all the effects with one shot, the illusions with one shot, and it was never interrupted. And you never cut to another camera. So it was legit. There were never camera tricks. Now, what would you do?
I would do the same. I think this, you know, I love the fact that we're in this world of technological miracles. It's incredible. But we've gone through many, you know, in the 60s, when I was a little kid, you know, we saw technology and, you know, video conferencing and all that, you know, that's going to happen in the future. And now we're doing it. All the Flash Gordon stuff exists today. All the Flintstones, what am I talking about? The Jetson stuff. We're living right now, and you are. You're like living in the middle of it. Look behind you. It's really that whole world that inspired you, inspired me, is all the kind of the future, you know, the Robbie the Robot future of possibilities. I'm in the possibility business, and I do digital things in my show. I do magic with people's cell phones in the audience, because they all have them. But it's kind of done in an analog way. I think this people trust seeing real stuff that's in front of them, not on TV. And that's what's so good about doing live magic in a live theater, you know, for live people, hopefully. I think that's never going to go away. I think we're okay. And today I would be doing what kids are doing today. I'd be developing new technology, new things. I love how magic has informed technology. The cinema was a magic effect. You know, you wouldn't have movies if it wasn't for a magician, Georges Méliès, who told stories with this newfangled piece of magic technology called the cinema. You know, a lot of devices here were the predecessors for radios, for smart homes. All those things existed as magic tricks before anything else. So I'm really proud to come from a legacy of inventors and creative people that are bringing things to society, but first keeping them as magic effects to entertain people and amaze people until finally it gets revealed and they get to use it.
Well, see, that's what to me is so important about the live show, as you spoke of. It's, you know, so many kids now are growing up with just watching it on their phones or watching it on TV, and that live theater experience is so different. I remember the first time I went to a professional football game. I'd watched them my entire life, my childhood with my father, and then we actually went to a Dallas Cowboy football game, and I could not believe the energy of that stadium when you walked in, and it was something completely different. And I think coming to see your show, it's just you're immersed in it all, and you don't get it until you're actually there. And
So come on down. Yeah. Check it out.
Exactly.
MGM Grand. Two shows a night, 3 on Saturday. And no days off. No,
yeah. Really? 7 days a week?
7 days a week. But then I take off 10 weeks during the year, little individual things.
And but it's all good. And do you have any – so your hobbies have to be what's behind you right there, right? You're not like a golfer or anything like that, are you?
Not a golfer, no. Live on a golf course, but not a golfer. I enjoy creating stuff. I really do. I enjoy
– Do you actually physically get in there and build things yourself? Or are you mainly designing and talking to
both. I make cardboard cutouts and foam core models of things and testing it. Now we have an iPhone. We can actually look how it's going to look and then play it right back and try again. It didn't exist when I was originally doing this. We had, you know, the camcorders for a while, but before that, not, you know, I think so. We get to test and try things out and see how they might look.
And is the plan for now is just MGM? Is there any touring in the future? I mean, let me jump on this first. So with Vegas, if people don't understand, when you're on the road, you're going to the people and you're going all over the country, all over the world. You're touring. Now you go to Vegas for a residency like you have, and the world is coming to you. Do you miss the road? Are you going to go back?
There's parts of the road that are fantastic, and you know, if you do a residency ever, you'll find that, you know, it's not the same. When you go to Dallas or you go to Chicago, the people have been waiting for a month or two, having bought their tickets and watching your material and reading up on you, and they come to the theater so excited because they're going to see you.
Try a year now. They've been holding on their tickets for a year.
That's
okay,
true.
Keep going.
In Las Vegas, there is 200 choices of shows. 200 choices. So they'll see me and they'll see another show and they'll see Celine Dion. They'll see, you know, whoever it is. And it's not quite the same as when they're just really passionately there to see you. I love traveling on the bus with pullouts and, you know, having a family doing that, you know, but I did it for like 30 years.
Wow.
You know, 40 years, like that. And it was great. And I loved it. I loved, you know, traveling to different countries and, you know, not learning the language and doing all that. But now I kind of, I'm more of a family, you know, person. And I get, you know, the COVID time had a few advantages. It allowed me to have dinner with my family every night.
That's cool. Right. Cause you've never gotten to do that. It's going to be a big adjustment going back now, isn't it? We talk about that.
I think so. You know, I had 10 weeks off a year, so I would have dinners with my family. But for 40 weeks of the year, I would not. And having holidays also, you know, I'm on holidays and doing 3 or 4 shows a day. But this past time, which had its major challenges, allowed us to have real family gatherings that I could actually show up at. That's pretty good.
And am I right in saying, we talked about this again months and months ago, and I was the same way, but you have a staff, and I think you've kept them on this whole time, correct?
Behind me is a library that we built with all my staff who were usually on stage. The library, it's a beautiful library. It was built from the COVID time, you know, it was built because of that. And there's a whole area back there that's incredible that we built and use the time to our advantage. I've been working very hard on new illusions, new technology, writing stuff and, you know, making notes on my iPhone, writing scripts and all that. When you write a script for a thing, do you write longhand? Do you put on your phone? Do you dictate? What do you do?
But right before COVID hit, I had a new hobby and I was collecting old typewriters. And I found that when I went back to the old typewriter, typing on a typewriter made me write better. Is that a correct sentence? Because I was forced to slow down and think about the words because you can't just highlight and delete again. But I do love...
Because you're a bad typist.
Yeah, there's that. But normally, I just do it on a computer because to me, every word is what's important. And especially in comedy, just a breath in the right place or the wrong place can kill a joke or make a joke. So, yeah, it's pretty much all on the computer. And, you know, I did my Comedy Central special that we did this past fall. All the jokes, I had a handful of writer friends and we wrote all the jokes. And then I performed it for the first time on stage live for the taping. So, yeah, that was nuts. COVID had gone to my head at that, but it turned out great. It was pretty good because, you know, David, you're on the stage long enough, you start to know what's going to work and what's not going to work. So, and it worked.
How many people were in that audience?
Well, I went from 10,000 in the last show in Florida to a little less than 100 at that outdoor venue, and everybody had masks on.
No.
I felt like my career was zooming.
Yeah. It's, and literally, it's zooming like this.
Yeah, exactly. So I also I looked at a bunch of articles and a bunch of different specials for you. And
I apologize that you had to do that.
It's unbelievable. It's great. When you made the jet disappear, you're walking through the wall of China, the escape from Alcatraz, the explosive encounter where you blew up the building. And that's where you played Talking Heads Burning Down the House. That was a little trite, but it was awesome. Did you talk to David Byrne about that?
Nah, I ripped them off. I own $5.
Of course you do. The Niagara Falls Challenge, when you're flying, the portal, the mystery of the 15th star. And those are that's just a handful of the amazing illusions, correct?
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you. I apologize for putting you through that torture, but yes.
And you have all those specials in your library. Do you own them all?
Yeah.
When are we going to have the DVD collection or the uploaded collection of all David Copperfield specials? Still waiting. Oh, man. I think that would be amazing. So are there any illusions that you can talk about now that you're creating? Anything that you're planning on right now? I know how you are. Everything is close to the vest. You don't reveal it until it's on stage. But what is amazing is you really can't practice this much. You get these things to where they're pretty great, and then you perform them, and it's not done. It's always, every illusion is a work in progress, correct?
It's totally true, and I try to, as Pixar people say, I try to make it suck less, and that takes many months. Now, you know, it's the same as you. I mean, you know, not that you have any sucky jokes, but it's like, you know, how long does it take you out of COVID to get something from the page to, you know, the stage, but then kind of work it out? Is it weeks or
months?
Oh,
no. See, I'm nuts. And that's where my writer friends think I'm crazy because if my show is 2 hours long on the road, I will then take a handful of spots in the middle and I'll write stuff on the bus literally minutes before I go on stage and then do them on stage, just trying them out. And if there's a few jokes in the middle of the show that die, who cares? Then I'll noodle them a little bit.
You sound like me. You know, people say, when are you going to do a new show? And I said, my show is like repertory theater. I'll put in a 5-minute thing here, and eventually the show, little by little, evolves out. Because, you know, I'm too chicken to have all new material like you just did for the COVID show. You know, I'm just slowly putting stuff in. It's a safer way. I blame the Beatles for it because the Beatles had, you know, a certain kind of music, but they slowly, in an album, would sneak in a very experimental piece. And if it worked, they expanded on that and kind of learned from what people liked. So I'm a,
I can't believe we've never had this conversation, because that's exactly how I do it. That's how I build a special. You can't just put a special on and then suddenly go out and you have a brand new show. 2 hours. You're taking too big of a chance like that. So yeah, I'll take my greatest hits and keep them in the show and then do the new stuff all scattered throughout. So at least you got some hits and you know some surefire stuff for the live show. And you're doing the same.
Yeah. And then I went to see Richard Pryor. Workout material, and you realize that, you know, you and I are doing a very good job. You're the best at what you do. I do okay, you know. I saw Pryor totally die at the peak of his career, die on stage, and just trying to write material, forcing himself to write. I think Jim Carrey did the same thing for a period, where he went on stage with nothing, zero, nothing, and you know the audience is screaming out, "Do the, you know, the cabinet routine, you know, whatever, right. Do the poster thing," and they know his material because they're like fans, and he refused to do it. He would just keep doing stuff, and it was a struggle, let me tell you. And you know, I went backstage to see him because I had a friend of a friend that knew him, so I was just trying to write, and it's like, wow, these are like really, you know, clouillons of steel, you know, to do that, and. You know, I don't, you know, I'm like you, I want to have safe stuff, but then I do take, you know, you're only as good as you dare to be bad. And I dare to be bad in segments within stuff and testing things out. And it is bad sometimes, but I eventually get it to work.
One question I forgot to ask you about the special. We talked about this years ago, and that is you would do the show before you shot the special probably, what, 100 times? Is that about right? 100 times before you shot it? More? Okay. More. But you would say that you'd go to a town, you'd do the show at the end of those 100 times, and you say if there's a reviewer that didn't like the show and wrote a bad review, you would say he was wrong. Because you've proven it to thousands of people, and they've loved it and stood up and give you standing ovations, and the one guy says he's wrong, and he didn't like it, and he's wrong. What, are you taking it back now?
I will tell you that I would read all the bad stuff.
Sure.
And really, it hurts. And then you see if there's any truth in it, you know?
Right.
We'd interview people after the shows. I'm famous for people coming backstage and me saying, you know, what'd you hate? What didn't you like? Come on, you hated that. And it's always so polite. And you have to pull out negatives out of them.
Well, nobody wants to say to you, I didn't like this.
Well, I force them to. And it's right. A real good thing for me. I'm kind of known for that. And, but yes, so I do ask for a lot of negative stuff, and I modify and tweak and try to find the truth, the potential improvement in those negative things, as hard as that is. Eventually, you must have read it that, you know, if I do it that many times and it works, if somebody doesn't like it, they're correct. Their opinion is that they didn't like it. But overall, you know, for me, they were wrong because they were outvoted. The audience votes. Right. And they were outvoted. Yeah,
and you're right. I do look at the negative stuff, and as much as it hurts, you know, if one person feels that, then there's a bunch of other people who feel the same way, and you do have to take it to heart and learn from it. You know, and I'm sure you're the same way. You'll have 1,000 people who say you're fantastic, and the one person that says, I don't like it, that it'll ruin your afternoon.
I really would like to win everybody, and you know, that's what. It's our disease that we have.
And do you talk directly to that person and try and draw them in?
Not talk to them, but I will kind of play to them and kind of, I it depends how frustrated I am. Everybody's cheering. You know, I'll get in there. Eventually I'll go, come on, this is good. No, you know, it's like.
And I bet you go backstage in a rotten mood if you don't get them, right?
No, not so bad. I think it's eventually. I think it's funny that it is there, and yeah. If I'm working on something new, I'll take it to heart because I realize that I'm still learning to the nuance of it, you know. And it's all good. I learn from my detractors far more than my celebration people.
Well, has there ever been a show where you, there has to have been, it was stupid me, but that you just walked away from and went, that really sucked, and I don't know if I want to do this anymore? Or was there ever that time along the way where you said, I don't know if this is going to work out. And I asked that question, but it's just nuts. You were at the top of your game at age 20. So, okay, let me go back. Was there a downtime when you said, I don't know if I can go any further? Ever?
Huh. I think probably. I think for me, it's not if I can go any further. It's more like, am I repeating myself? Am I copying myself? Many people copy what I do. There's people in France and they're taking inventions that I spent years on and just steal them.
Sure.
And there was a time where, you know, it was happening so much that I stopped creating new magic. I stopped it. I kept doing my show. You know, the show was still running. But I stopped creating new magic and I started working on those islands you were talking about. Put all my creative energy and my staff's energy into those islands to make them really special and magical and make them experiential and make them really great. And for 4 years, I just had the same show and it was fine. People were coming and nobody seemed to mind. And I worked on the island. I'd done it with a few other projects, but then I got it back. I got the spark back. And, you know, my frustrations of being copied or being, thinking that if I was continuing to do more of the same thing, I'd look like a copy of them copying me. But I found a new way, a new direction for it, and I found a new way of doing it, and it made it worthwhile. I needed that spark again. I think a lot of artists go through the same thing.
Yeah, if it's somebody who's painting in oils or whatever, you've got those lulls of,
Blue periods.
Oh, that's a great way of putting it, yeah. And where you don't know if you have it anymore or if you don't want to do it anymore. And for whatever reason, if it's life threw you something, like you got guys copying you and it's a little bit discouraging, and it's really healthy to go and find another hobby or do something else, even if you're still doing your job and almost hitting play when you walk on stage, and eventually that spark comes back. And I wish it was as simple as drinking a cup of coffee, but you never know what it is that's going to bring it back and you get excited again.
I know. And you know, don't give up hope. I can tell you that, you know, it does. You do find it again, if you're worth anything, you know, creatively worth anything. And I just, you know, I kept doing the shows. I still love doing the shows and people were happy to be there and so forth. But as far as creating new things, I need to find a new thing to inspire me. I'm re-inspired again now. Yeah. After COVID, I found another whole nother thing to do. It has to be really worth doing for me. And I found some stuff that's worth doing. So stand by.
Okay, so you're talking, that's that secret part. I asked you that question and now it comes out. Yeah, there's something, but you're not going to tell us. Is that what you just said?
That's what I said.
And then on a time frame like that, again, you'll work on these illusions for years.
Yes.
And so when you talk about this, is this something that we'll see a piece of soon or no?
I think so. I think in the next 5 months, you might see a piece of it. Like you said, I'll test it in the show, one piece of it, and see what people think. And no, one of my talents is I'm a good listener. I listen and provoke people to, you know, provide criticisms to guide me through it.
And how many people around you do you have that work for you that are good critics that way and you trust? Or your wife? Does Chloe critique you?
Or yeah, you bet. Yeah. And she's French, so it's like her nose is up in the air. And,
you know, it's good. Wait a minute. Helpful. Was the French knighting before or after Chloe?
Way before.
Oh, was it really?
Way before.
That's great. And is it a secret as to how many folks actually work for you? Can I ask that?
Oh, many as 30 or 40 in my show, but my magic lab team of three or four people, key creative people that are doing that kind of thing.
And are you an easy guy to work for, Mr. Copperfield?
Depends on the day, I think. You know, depends on the time pressure we're under. I think normally it's...
Let me guess. If somebody's doing their job well, you're fine. It's when somebody screws up because they're just not doing their job well. Is that when you get upset with them? They're not trying hard enough?
I'm way better. You know, I used to be... very, very angry more often. You know, I'm way better at it, letting it go. But remember that in my world, in your world, right? If there's a lighting cue that goes bad in your show, the puppet keeps talking and you keep getting laughs.
Right.
If a lighting cue goes wrong in my show and the illusion is exposed, then I'm a bad magician. Right. And they walk out of the theater saying, do you see that thing that happened? And the thing I saw, it worked. And it wasn't even my fault. It's because a lighting cue was wrong, or a piece of scenery wasn't in the right place, or the timing was wrong. So it's really a lot of pressure on a lot of people to make sure that they do everything at the right time and in the right way, because of relying on kind of cooperation of a team.
Well, that is something to consider that I didn't. And you're right, because the handful of times, I mean, I've had my crew for, 10 years, same guys. And in one show out of 100, if one little audio cue or video cue goes wrong, I'm not a happy man. So I can't have imagined every turn in your show is a timed lighting or sound cue or video cue or whatever. So yeah, I think you'd be justified.
And then I'm a bad magician then. I'm a bad, you still can have a bad lighting cue, but you're still a great ventriloquist and a great comedian. I'm a bad magician if it exposes the magic thing. Imagine being funny on stage, knowing that behind that curtain, they're setting up something that could go really wrong. You know, it's like, and I've got to stay present and there and, in the moment when disaster is taking place upstage.
And then you have to control yourself on stage, because if you suddenly get angry, then you're the a-hole. And that's what people talk about more.
A couple times it's happened, not much, but a few times.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that. I wasn't trying to step into anything. All right. But I can imagine. That just doesn't sound fun. All right. So MGM Grand, and how many people a show at this point in time are allowed in?
Oh, well, 250.
Oh, that's a great number. That's like a really big bar mitzvah, right?
Yes, just like mine. Just like.
All right, good.
Bring the savings bonds are on their way.
Super. And so it's just an unending contract. You're going to be there for a good while, correct?
Yeah.
All right.
Yes, that's all good.
That's great. And the museum, it's by invitation. And will it ever be for the public?
I do bring the public things out of here for the public. I do exhibits in New York, in L.A., in Chicago. I do exhibits of this material outside of here. And
Well, let me give a plug for that. I didn't do that up front. This is you obviously phrase it. It's the largest collection in the world.
Yeah, it's of magical ephemera, artifacts, costumes, posters. It's an amazing thing.
I mean, you're being humble here, but you've got some of Houdini's greatest illusions, correct?
Right behind the camera, yeah.
Like, just name one.
Water torture cell, milk can escape, metamorphosis trunk, and the Dakota expanding die.
And you yourself have had a handful of close calls, correct?
Yes. Next question.
Okay, next question. All right, well, that's great. Well, David, I really appreciate this time a lot. This has been a lot of fun, and I got to tell folks, if they want to see an amazing show, you have been around forever, and for folks who are too young to have not seen your specials, the live show.
YouTube.
What? YouTube?
YouTube. What? Sure.
Some of your specials are on YouTube.
Sure.
Oh, I look straight for talking about you. I didn't look for the specials. I saw a few things, but all right, that's great. But no, they have to come see the live show. Don't tell them to go to YouTube, David. It's a giant that's commercial true. Right now.
It's a taste. It's a taste, yeah.
It's great. All right, my friend. And by the way, you look, I know everybody always says this, but you look fantastic. It's amazing that you're 78 years old. It's unbelievable.
92.
No, but seriously, though, you're like, I think you're like 10 years older than me, something like that. No, 8, 6, 6, 7, 7. I don't know what it is, something like that. But your fountain.
39 again.
But your fountain of youth on your islands, you got to bottle that stuff.
I drink the Kool-Aid.
That's great. All right. Well, thanks, Mr. Copperfield. You're fantastic. Keep going. We look forward to whatever comes next.
Same to the best.
All right.
You're awesome.
That was awesome, David Copperfield.
You like that? Yeah. I love also the thing that was behind him.
Yeah, it was his warehouse.
Very cool. You guys should look closer. There's all kinds of cool stuff behind Copperfield. It's great.
Cool. Can I go?
You want to go to the warehouse? Well,
sure.
No.
All right. So now we have our comedy clip.
Our comedy clip. And this one is with me.
That's right. And Matt, this is from Arguing With Myself.
That's right.
All right. So, Peanut, you know what this is?
Oh, we chose this clip because it references David Copperfield, a magician kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. All right. Here it is.
So where were we before this? Before this, we were in D.C. Ah, yes, Washington, D.C., doing a show in a theater, a lovely theater. About 5 minutes in the show, I hadn't looked down. About where you're sitting, dude, there was a guy sitting right there where you are. The he was facing that way. Right. And every time I said something, the guy went... And I go, hey, buddy, what are you doing? The guy was a signer, right? A signer! Think about this for a second. They brought a bunch of deaf people to see the ventriloquist! What? What do you do next week? Going to take on a blind folks to see David Copperfield. The elephant disappeared. It just f***ing disappeared.
Well, there you go. That's it for this week's podcast. Be sure and tune in next week for our next one. Duh. Yeah, Apple Podcast or your favorite podcast provider. We don't know. What is it? Instathart? What's it called?
Oh, dear.
What is it called? The other one. The other big one. No, the one that Rogan went to. What's it called?
Spotify.
Spotify. Instafart. Spotify. It's the same
thing. Instafart.
You watch on YouTube or on Facebook.
Subscribe, like, comment, hit the notifications bell, and then get a life. That's it.